When the moon was made? I asked. I remember lots of things, she said. Will I come back here again? I asked. That's not for you to know, said the old woman. Get along now, said Ginny Hempstock gently. There's people who are wondering where you've got to. And when she mentioned them, I realized with an awkward horror that my sister, her husband, her children, all the well-wishers and mourners and visitors would be puzzling over what had become of me. Still, if there was a day that they would find my absent ways easy to forgive, it was today. It had been a long day and a hard one. I was glad that it was over. I said, I hope that I haven't been a bother. No, dear, said the old woman. No bother at all. I heard a cat meow. A moment later, it sauntered out of the shadows and into a patch of bright moonlight. It approached me confidently, pushed its head against my shoe. I crouched beside it and scratched its forehead, stroked its back. It was a beautiful cat, black, or so I imagined, the moonlight having swallowed the color of things. It had a white spot over one ear. I said, I used to have a cat like this. I called her Ocean. She was beautiful. I don't actually remember what happened to her. You brought her back to us, said Ginny Hempstock. She touched my shoulder with her hand, squeezing it for a heartbeat. She touched my cheek with her fingertips, as if I were a small child or a lover. And then she walked away, back into the night. I picked up my plate and my mug, and I carried them along the path with me as we made our way back to the house, the old woman and I. The moon does shine as bright as day, I said, like in the song. It's good to have a full moon, she agreed. I said, it's funny. For a moment I thought there were two of you. Isn't that odd? It's just me, said the old woman. It's only ever... just me. I know, I said. Of course it is. I was going to take the plate and mug into the kitchen and put them in the sink, but she stopped me at the farmhouse door. You ought to get back to your family now, she said. They'll be sending out a search party. They'll forgive me, I said. I hoped that they would. My sister would be concerned, and there would be people I barely knew disappointed not to have told me how very, very sorry they were for my loss. You've been so kind, letting me sit and think here by the pond. I'm very grateful. Stuff and nonsense, she said. Nothing kind about it. Next time Letty writes from Australia, I said, please tell her I said hello. I will, she said. She'll be glad you thought of her. I got into the car and started the engine. The old woman stood in the doorway, watching me, politely, until I had turned the car around and was on my way back up the lane. I looked back at the farmhouse in my rearview mirror, and a trick of the light made it seem as if two moons hung in the sky above it, like a pair of eyes watching me from above, one moon perfectly full and round, the other, its twin on the other side of the sky, a half moon. Curiously, I turned in my seat and looked back. A single half moon hung over the farmhouse, peaceful and pale and perfect. I wondered where the illusion of the second moon had come from, but I only wondered it for a moment, and then I dismissed it from my thoughts. Perhaps it was an afterimage, I decided, or a ghost. Something that had stirred in my mind for a moment so powerfully that I believed it to be real, but now was gone and faded into the past like a memory forgotten or a shadow into the dusk. Acknowledgements. This book is the book you've just listened to. It's done. Now we're in the acknowledgements. This is not really part of the book. You do not have to listen to it. It's mostly just names. I owe thanks to so many people. The ones who were there in my life when I needed them. The ones who brought me tea. the ones who wrote the books that brought me up. To single any of them out is foolish, but here I go. When I finished this book, I sent it to many of my friends to read, and they read it with wise eyes and they told me what worked for them and what needed work. I'm grateful to all of them, but particular thanks must go to Maria Davana Headley, Olga Nunes, Alina Simone, Queen of Titles, Gary K. Wolfe, Kat Howard, Kelly McCullough, Eric Sussman, Haley Campbell, Valia Lupescu, Melissa Marr, Elise Marshall, Anthony Martignetti, Peter Straub, Kat Dennings, Jean Wolfe, Gwenda Bond, Anne Bobby, Lee Budgie Barnett, Maurice Chamar, Farah Mendelson, Henry Selleck, Claire Coney, Grace Monk, and Cornelia Funke. This novel began, although I did not know it was going to be a novel at the time, when Jonathan Strahan asked me to write him a short story. I started to tell the story of the opal miner and the Hempstock family who've lived in the farm in my head for such a long time. And Jonathan was forgiving and kind when I finally admitted to myself and to him that this wasn't a short story, and I let it become a novel instead. The family in this book is not my own family, who have been gracious in letting me plunder the landscape of my own childhood and watched as I liberally reshaped those places into a story. I'm grateful to them all, especially to my youngest sister, Lizzie, who encouraged me and sent me long-forgotten memory-jogging photographs. I wish I'd remembered the old greenhouse in time to put it into the book. In Sarasota, Florida, Stephen King reminded me of the joy of just writing every day. Words save our lives sometimes. Tori gave me a safe house to write it in, and I cannot thank her enough. Art Spiegelman gave me his kind permission to use a word balloon from his collaborative conversation with Maurice Sendak in The New Yorker as the opening epigraph. As this book entered its second draft, as I was typing out my handwritten first draft, I would read the day's work to my wife, Amanda, at night, in bed, and I learned more about the words I'd written when reading them aloud to her than I ever have learned about anything I've done. She was the book's first reader, and her puzzlement and occasional frustration, her questions and her delight, were my guides through subsequent drafts. I wrote this book for Amanda when she was far away, and I missed her very much. My life would be grayer and duller without her. My daughters, Holly and Maddie, and my son, Michael, were my wisest and gentlest critics of all. I have wonderful editors on both sides of the Atlantic, Jennifer Brell and Jane Morpeth and Rosemary Brosnan, who all read the book in first draft and all suggested different things I needed to change and fix and rebuild. Jane and Jennifer have also both coped extremely well with the arrival of a book that none of us was expecting, not even me. I would very much like to thank the committee for the Zena Sutherland Lectures held at the Chicago Public Library. The Zena Sutherland lecture I delivered in 2012 was, in retrospect, mostly a conversation with myself about this book while I was writing it, to try and understand what I was writing and who it was for. Merrily Heifetz has been my literary agent for 25 years now. Her support on this book, as with everything over the last quarter of a century, was invaluable. John Levin, my agent for films and such, is a fine reader and does a mean Ringo Starr impression. The good folk of Twitter were extremely helpful when I needed to double-check how much blackjacks and fruit salad sweets cost in the 1960s. Without them, I might have written my book twice as fast. And lastly, my thanks to the Hempstock family, who in one form or another have always been there when I needed them. Neil Gaiman, Isle of Skye, July 2012. This is Neil Gaiman. This production of The Ocean at the End of the Lane was recorded at Tequila Mockingbird in Austin, Texas. Engineered by Shayna Brown. It was produced by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, Technical Director, Executive Producer, Caitlin Gehring. Text copyright 2013 by Neil Gaiman. Production copyright 2013 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. And thank you so much for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Only eaten it to prevent it from going to waste, and for a fraction of a moment my entire childhood felt like a lie. It was as if one of the pillars of belief that my world had been built upon had crumbled into dry sand. The policeman spoke into a radio in the front of his car. Then he crossed the road and came over to me. "Sorry about this, Sonny," he said. "There's going to be a few more cars coming down this road in a minute. We should find you somewhere to wait that you won't be in the way. Would you like to sit in the back of my car again?" I shook my head. I didn't want to sit there again. Somebody, a girl, said, "He can come back with me to the farmhouse. It's no trouble." She was much older than me, at least 11. Her red-brown hair was worn relatively short for a girl, and her nose was snub. She was freckled. She wore a red skirt. Girls didn't wear jeans much back then, not in those parts. She had a soft Sussex accent and sharp grey-blue eyes. The girl went with the policeman over to my father, and she got permission to take me away, and then I was walking down the lane with her. I said, "There is a dead man in our car." "That's why he came down here," she told me. "The end of the road. Nobody's going to find him and stop him around here, 3 o'clock in the morning. And the mud there is wet and easy to mould." "Do you think he killed himself?" "Yes." "Do you like milk? Gran's milking Bessie now." I said, "You mean real milk from a cow?" And then felt foolish. But she nodded reassuringly. I thought about this. I'd never had milk that didn't come from a bottle. I think I'd like that. We stopped at a small barn where an old woman, much older than my parents, with long grey hair like cobwebs and a thin face, was standing beside a cow. Long black tubes were attached to each of the cow's teats. "We used to milk them by hand," she told me, "but this is easier." She showed me how the milk went from the cow down the black tubes and into the machine, through a cooler, and into huge metal churns. The churns were left on a heavy wooden platform outside the barn, where they would be collected each day by a lorry. The old lady gave me a cup of creamy milk from Bessie the cow, the fresh milk before it had gone through the cooler. Nothing I had drunk had ever tasted like that before. Rich and warm and perfectly happy in my mouth. I remembered that milk after I had forgotten everything else.
"There's more of them up the lane," said the old woman suddenly. "All sorts coming down with lights flashing and all. Such a palaver. You should get the boy into the kitchen. He's hungry, and a cup of milk won't do a growing boy."
The girl said, "Have you eaten?" "Just a piece of toast. It was burned." She said, "My name's Letty. Letty Hempstock. This is Hempstock Farm. Come on." She took me in through the front door and into their enormous kitchen, sat me down at a huge wooden table so stained and patterned that it looked as if faces were staring up at me from the old wood. "We have breakfast here early," she said. "Milking starts at first light, but there's porridge in the saucepan and jam to put in it." She gave me a china bowl filled with warm porridge from the stovetop, with a lump of homemade blackberry jam, my favourite, in the middle of the porridge. Then she poured cream on it. I swished it around with my spoon before I ate it, swirling it into a purple mess, and was as happy as I have ever been about anything. It tasted perfect. A stocky woman came in. Her red-brown hair was streaked with grey and cut short. She had apple cheeks, a dark green skirt that went to her knees, and Wellington boots. She said, "This must be the boy from the top of the lane. Such a business going on with that car. There'll be 5 of them needing tea soon." Letty filled a huge copper kettle from the tap. She lit a gas hob with a match and put the kettle onto the flame. Then she took down 5 chipped mugs from a cupboard and hesitated, looking at the woman. The woman said, "You're right, 6. The doctor will be here too." Then the woman pursed her lips and made a noise. "They've missed the note,"
she said. He wrote it so carefully, too, folded it and put it in his breast pocket, and they haven't looked there yet.
What does it say?
Asked Letty. Well, read it yourself, said the woman. I thought she was Letty's mother. She seemed like she was somebody's mother. And then she said, it says that he took all the money that his friends had given him to smuggle out of South Africa and bank for them in England, along with all the money he'd made over the years mining for opals, and he went to the casino in Brighton to gamble. But he only meant to gamble with his own money. And then he only meant to dip into the money his friends had given him until he'd made back the money he had lost. And then he didn't have anything, said the woman, and all was dark.
That's not what he wrote, though, said Letty, squinting her eyes. What he wrote was, to all my friends, I am sorry it was not like I meant to, and hope you can find it in your hearts to forgive me, for I cannot forgive myself.
Same thing, said the older woman. She turned to me. I'm Letty's ma, she said. You'll have met my mother already in the milking shed. I'm Mrs. Hempstock, but she was Mrs. Hempstock before me, so she's old Mrs. Hempstock. This is Hempstock Farm. It's the oldest farm hereabouts. It's in the Doomsday Book. I wondered why they were all called Hempstock, those women, but I did not ask, any more than I dared to ask how they knew about the suicide note or what the opal miner had thought as he died. They were perfectly matter-of-fact about it. Letty said, I nudged him to look in the breast pocket. He'll think he thought of it himself.
There's a good girl, said Mrs. Hempstock.
They'll be in here when the kettle boils to ask if I've seen anything unusual and to have their tea. Why don't you take the boy down to the pond?
It's not a pond, said Letty. It's my ocean.
She turned to me and said, come on. She led me out of the house the way we had come. The day was still grey. We walked around the house, down the cow path.
Is it a real ocean? I asked.
Oh, yes, she said. We came on it suddenly. A wooden shed, an old bench, and between them a duck pond. Dark water spotted with duckweed and lily pads. There was a dead fish, silver as a coin, floating on its side on the surface.
That's not good, said Letty.
I thought you said it was an ocean, I told her. It's just a pond, really.
It is an ocean, she said.
We came across it when I was just a baby, from the old country. Letty went into the shed and came out with a long bamboo pole with what looked like a shrimping net on the end. She leaned over, carefully pushed the net beneath the dead fish. She pulled it out. But Hempstock Farm is in the Doomsday Book, I said. Your mum said so, and that was William the Conqueror.
Yes, said Letty Hempstock.
She took the dead fish out of the net and examined it. It was still soft, not stiff, and it flopped in her hand. I had never seen so many colours. It was silver, yes, but beneath the silver was blue and green and purple, and each scale was tipped with black.
What kind of fish is it? I asked.
This is very odd, she said. I mean, mostly fish in this ocean don't die anyway. She produced a horn-handled pocket knife, although I could not have told you from where, and she pushed it into the stomach of the fish and sliced along toward the tail.
This is what killed her, said Letty.
She took something from inside the fish. Then she put it, still greasy from the fish guts, into my hand. I bent down, dipped it into the water, rubbed my fingers across it to clean it off. I stared at it. Queen Victoria's face stared back at me.
Sixpence, I said.
The fish ate a sixpence?
It's not good, is it?
Said Letty Hempstock. There was a little sunshine now. It showed the freckles that clustered across her cheeks and nose, and where the sunlight touched her hair, it was a coppery red. And then she said, your father's wondering where you are. Time to be getting back. I tried to give her the little silver sixpence, but she shook her head. You keep it, she said. You can buy chocolates or sherbet lemons.
I don't think I can,
I said. It's too small. I don't know if shops will take sixpences like these nowadays. Then put it in your piggy bank, she said. It might bring you luck. She said this doubtfully, as if she were uncertain what kind of luck it would bring. The policeman and my father, and two men in brown suits and ties, were standing in the farmhouse kitchen. One of the men told me he was a policeman, but he wasn't wearing a uniform, which I thought was disappointing. If I were a policeman, I was certain I would wear my uniform whenever I could. The other man with a suit and tie I recognized as Dr. Smithson, our family doctor. They were finishing their tea. My father thanked Mrs. Hempstock and Letty for taking care of me, and they said I was no trouble at all and that I could come again. The policeman who had driven us down to the Mini now drove us back to our house and dropped us off at the end of the drive. "Probably best if you don't talk about this to your sister," said my father. I didn't want to talk about it to anybody. I had found a special place and made a new friend and lost my comic, and I was holding an old-fashioned silver sixpence tightly in my hand. I said, "What makes the ocean different to the sea?" "Bigger," said my father. "An ocean is much bigger than the sea. Why?" "Just thinking," I said. "Could you have an ocean that was as small as a pond?" "No," said my father. "Ponds are pond-sized. Lakes are lake-sized. Seas are seas and oceans are oceans. Atlantic, Pacific, Indian, Arctic. I think that's all of the oceans there are." My father went up to his bedroom to talk to my mum and to be on the phone up there. I dropped the silver sixpence into my piggy bank. It was the kind of china piggy bank from which nothing could be removed. One day, when it could hold no more coins, I would be allowed to break it. But it was far from full. Chapter 3. I never saw the White Mini again. 2 days later, on Monday, my father took delivery of a black Rover with cracked red leather seats. It was a bigger car than the Mini had been, but not as comfortable. The smell of old cigars permeated the leather upholstery, and long drives in the back of the Rover always left us feeling carsick. The black Rover was not the only thing to arrive on Monday morning. I also received a letter. I was 7 years old, and I never got letters. I got cards on my birthday from my grandparents and from Ellen Henderson, my mother's friend, whom I did not know. On my birthday, Ellen Henderson, who lived in a camper van, would send me a handkerchief. I did not get letters. Even so, I would check the post every day to see if there was anything for me. And that morning, there was. I opened it, did not understand what I was looking at, and took it to my mother. "You've won the premium bonds," she said. "What does that mean?" "When you were born, when all of her grandchildren were born, your grandma bought you a premium bond, and when the number gets chosen, you can win thousands of pounds." "Did I win thousands of pounds?" "No." She looked at the slip of paper. "You've won £25. I was sad not to have won thousands of pounds. I already knew what I would buy with it. I would buy a place to go and be alone, like a bat cave with a hidden entrance. But I was delighted to be in possession of a fortune beyond my previous imaginings. £25. I could buy 4 little blackjack or fruit salad sweets for a penny. They were a farthing each, although there were no more farthings. £25 at 240 pennies to the pound and 4 sweets to the penny was more sweets than I could easily imagine. "I'll put it in your post office account," said my mother, crushing my dreams. I did not have any more sweets than I had had that morning. Even so, I was rich, £25 richer than I had been moments before. I had never won anything, ever. I made her show me the piece of paper with my name on it again before she put it into her handbag. That was Monday morning. In the afternoon, the ancient Mr. Wallery, who came in on Monday and Thursday afternoons to do some gardening. At Mrs. Wallery, his equally ancient wife, who wore galoshes, huge, semi-transparent overshoes, would come in on Wednesday afternoons and clean, was digging in the vegetable garden and dug up a bottle filled with pennies and halfpennies and threepenny bits and even farthings. None of the coins was dated later than 1937, and I spent the afternoon polishing them with brown sauce and vinegar to make them shine. My mother put the bottle of old coins on the mantelpiece of the dining room and said that she expected that a coin collector might pay several pounds for them. I went to bed that night happy and excited. I was rich. Buried treasure had been discovered. The world was a good place. I don't remember how the dreams started, but that's the way of dreams, isn't it? I know that I was in school and having a bad day, hiding from the kinds of kids who hit me and called me names, but they found me anyway, deep in the rhododendron thicket behind the school. And I knew it must be a dream. But in the dream I didn't know this. It was real and it was true, because my grandfather was with them and his friends, old men with grey skin and hacking coughs. They held sharp pencils, the kind that drew blood when you were jabbed with them. I ran from them, but they were faster than I was, the old men and the big boys, and in the boys' toilets, where I had hidden in a cubicle, they caught up with me. They held me down, forced my mouth wide open. My grandfather. But it was not my grandfather. It was really a waxwork of my grandfather, intent on selling me to anatomy. Held something sharp and glittering, and he began pushing it into my mouth with his stubby fingers. It was hard and sharp and familiar, and it made me gag and choke, my mouth filled with a metallic taste. They were looking at me with mean, triumphant eyes, all the people in the boys' toilets, and I tried not to choke on the thing in my throat, determined not to give them that satisfaction. I woke, and I was choking. I could not breathe. There was something in my throat, hard and sharp, and stopping me from breathing or from crying out. I began to cough as I woke, tears streaming down my cheeks, nose running. I pushed my fingers as deeply as I could into my mouth, desperate and panicked and determined. With the tip of my forefinger, I felt the edge of something hard. I put the middle finger on the other side of it, choking myself, clamping the thing between them, and I pulled whatever it was out of my throat. I gasped for breath, and then I half-vomited onto my bedsheets, threw up a clear drool flecked with blood from where the thing had cut my throat as I had pulled it out. I did not look at the thing. It was tight in my hand, slimy with my saliva and my phlegm. I did not want to look at it. I did not want it to exist, the bridge between my dream and the waking world. I ran down the hallway to the bathroom, down at the far end of the house. I washed my mouth out, drank directly from the cold tap, spat red into the white sink. Only when I'd done that did I sit on the side of the white bathtub and open my hand. I was scared. But what was in my hand, what had been in my throat, wasn't scary. It was only a coin, a silver shilling. I went back to the bedroom. I dressed myself, cleaned the vomit from my sheets as best I could with a damp face flannel. I hoped that the sheets would dry before I had to sleep in the bed that night. Then I went downstairs. I wanted to tell someone about the shilling, but I did not know who to tell. I knew enough about adults to know that if I did tell them what had happened, I would not be believed. Adults rarely seemed to believe me when I told the truth anyway. Why would they believe me about something so unlikely? My sister was playing in the back garden with some of her friends. She ran over to me angrily when she saw me. She said, "I hate you. I'm telling Mummy and Daddy when they come home." "What?" "You know," she said. "I know it was you." "What was me?" "Throwing coins at me, at all of us, from the bushes. That was just nasty." "But I didn't." "It hurt." She went back to her friends and they all glared at me. My throat felt painful and ragged. I walked down the drive. I don't know where I was thinking of going. I just didn't want to be there any longer.
Letty Hempstock was standing at the bottom of the drive, beneath the chestnut trees. She looked as if she had been waiting for 100 years and could wait for another 100. She wore a white dress, but the light coming through the chestnut's young spring leaves stained it green. I said, "Hello." She said, "You were having bad dreams, weren't you?" I took the shilling out of my pocket and showed it to her. "I was choking on it," I told her, "when I woke up, but I don't know how it got into my mouth. If someone had put it into my mouth, I would have woken up. It was just in there when I woke."
"Yes," she said.
"My sister says I threw coins at them from the bushes, but I didn't."
"No," she agreed, "you didn't."
I said, "Letty, what's happening?"
"Oh," she said, as if it was obvious,
"someone's just trying to give people money, that's all. But it's doing it very badly, and it's stirring things up around here that should be asleep, and that's not good."
"Is it something to do with the man who died?"
"Something to do with him, yes."
"Is he doing this?"
She shook her head.
Then she said, "Have you had breakfast?"
I shook my head. "Well then," she said, "come on." We walked down the lane together. There were a few houses down the lane, here and there, back then, and she pointed to them as we went past.
"In that house," said Letty Hempstock, "a man dreamed of being sold and of being turned into money. Now he's started seeing things in mirrors."
"What kinds of things?"
"Himself,
but with fingers poking out of his eye sockets, and things coming out of his mouth, like crab claws." I thought about people with crab legs coming out of their mouths in mirrors.
"Why did I find a shilling in my throat?"
"He wanted people to have money."
"The opal miner who died in the car?"
"Yes, sort of. Oh, not exactly. He started all this off, like someone lighting a fuse on a firework. His death lit the touch paper. The thing that's exploding right now, that isn't him. That's somebody else. Something else."
She rubbed her freckled nose with a grubby hand.
"A lady's gone mad in that house," she told me, and it would not have occurred to me to doubt her. "She has money in the mattress. Now she won't get out of bed in case someone takes it from her."
"How do you know?"
She shrugged. "Once you've been around for a bit, you get to know stuff."
I kicked a stone.
"By a bit, do you mean a really long time?"
She nodded.
"How old are you, really?" I asked.
11?
I thought for a bit. Then I asked, "How long have you been 11 for?"
She smiled at me.
We walked past Caraway Farm. The farmers, whom one day I would come to know as Caliander's parents, were standing in their farmyard, shouting at each other. They stopped when they saw us. When we rounded a bend in the lane and were out of sight, Letty said, "Those poor people."
"Why are they poor people?"
"Because they've been having money problems. And this morning he had a dream where she was doing bad things. To earn money. So he looked in her handbag and found lots of folded up 10-shilling notes. She says she doesn't know where they came from, and he doesn't believe her. He doesn't know what to believe."
"All the fighting and the dreams. It's about money, isn't it?"
"I'm not sure," said Letty, and she seemed so grown up then that I was almost scared of her.
"Whatever's happening," she said eventually, "it can all be sorted out."
She saw the expression on my face then, worried, scared even, and she said, "After pancakes." Letty cooked his pancakes on a big metal griddle on the kitchen stove. They were paper thin, and as each pancake was done, Letty would squeeze lemon onto it and plop a blob of plum jam into the center and roll it tightly, like a cigar. When there were enough, we sat at the kitchen table and wolfed them down. There was a hearth in that kitchen, and there were ashes still smouldering in the hearth from the night before. That kitchen was a friendly place, I thought. I said to Letty,
I'm scared. She smiled at me. I'll make sure you're safe, I promise. I'm not scared. I was still scared, but not as much. It's just scary. I said, I promise, said Letty Hempstock. I won't let you be hurt.
Hurt?
Said a high, cracked voice. Who's hurt? What's been hurt? Why would anybody be hurt? It was old Mrs. Hempstock, her apron held between her hands, and in the hollow of the apron so many daffodils that the light reflected up from them transformed her face to gold, and the kitchen seemed bathed in yellow light. Letty said, "Something's causing trouble. It's giving people money, in their dreams and in real life." She showed the old lady my shilling. My friend found himself choking on this shilling when he woke up this morning. Old Mrs. Hempstock put her apron on the kitchen table, rapidly moved the daffodils off the cloth and onto the wood. Then she took the shilling from Letty. She squinted at it, sniffed it, rubbed at it, listened to it, or put it to her ear, at any rate, then touched it with the tip of her purple tongue.
"It's new,"
she said at last. "It says 1912 on it, but it didn't exist yesterday." Letty said, "I knew there was something funny about it." I looked up at old Mrs. Hempstock.
"How do you know?" "Good question, lovey. It's electron decay, mostly. You have to look at things closely to see the electrons. They're the little dinky ones that look like tiny smiles. The neutrons are the grey ones that look like frowns. The electrons were all a bit too smiley for 1912, so then I checked the sides of the letters and the old king's head, and everything was a tad too crisp and sharp. Even where they were worn, it was as if they'd been made to be worn."
"You must have very good eyesight," I told her. I was impressed. She gave me back the coin.
"Not as good as it once was, but then when you get to be my age, your eyesight won't be as sharp as it once was neither."
And she let out a guffaw, as if she'd said something very funny.
"How old is that?"
Letty looked at me, and I was worried that I'd said something rude. Sometimes adults didn't like to be asked their ages, and sometimes they did. In my experience, old people did. They were proud of their ages. Mrs. Wallery was 77, and Mr. Wallery was 89, and they liked telling us how old they were. Old Mrs. Hempstock went over to a cupboard and took out several colourful vases.
"Old enough," she said. "I remember when the moon was made."
"Hasn't there always been a moon?"
"Bless you, not in the slightest. I remember the day the moon came. We looked up in the sky. It was all dirty brown and sooty grey here, then not green and blue."
She half-filled each of the vases at the sink. Then she took a pair of blackened kitchen scissors and snipped off the bottom half-inch of stem from each of the daffodils. I said, "Are you sure it's not that man's ghost doing this? Are you sure we aren't being haunted?" They both laughed then, the girl and the old woman, and I felt stupid. I said, "Sorry."
"Ghosts can't make things," said Letty. "They aren't even good at moving things."
Old Mrs. Hempstock said, "Go and get your mother. She's doing laundry." Then to me, "You shall help me with the daffs." I helped her put the flowers into the vases, and she asked my opinion on where to put the vases in the kitchen. We placed the vases where I suggested, and I felt wonderfully important. The daffodils sat like patches of sunlight, making that dark wooden kitchen even more cheerful. The floor was made of red and grey flagstones. The walls were whitewashed. The old woman gave me a lump of honeycomb from the Hempstock's own beehive on a chipped saucer and poured a little cream over it from a jug. I ate it with a spoon, chewing the wax like gum, letting the honey flow into my mouth, sweet and sticky with an aftertaste of wildflowers. I was scraping the last of the cream and honey from the saucer when Letty and her mother came into the kitchen. Mrs. Hempstock still had big Wellington boots on, and she strode in as if she were in an enormous hurry.
"Mother," she said, giving the boy honey, "you'll rot his teeth."
Old Mrs. Hempstock shrugged. "I'll have a word with the wigglers in his mouth," she said. "Get them to leave his teeth alone."
"You can't just boss bacteria around like that," said the younger Mrs. Hempstock. "They don't like it."
"Stuff and silliness," said the old lady. "You leave wigglers alone and they'll be carrying on like anything. Show them who's boss and they can't do enough for you. You've tasted my cheese."
She turned to me. "I've won medals for my cheese. Medals. Back in the old king's day, there were those who'd ride for a week to buy a round of my cheese. They said that the king himself had it with his bread. And his boys, Prince Dickon and Prince Geoffrey and even little Prince John, they swore it was the finest cheese they had ever tasted."
"Gran," said Letty, and the old lady stopped mid-flow.
Letty's mother said, "You'll be needing a hazel wand. And," she added somewhat doubtfully, "I suppose you could take the lad. It's his coin, and it'll be easier to carry if he's with you. Something she made?"
"She," said Letty.
She was holding her horn-handled penknife, with the blade closed.
"Tastes like a she," said Letty's mother. "I might be wrong, mind."
"Don't take the boy," said old Mrs. Hempstock. "Asking for trouble, that is." I was disappointed.
"Oh, we'll be fine," said Letty. "I'll take care of him. Him and me. It'll be an adventure, and he'll be company. Please, Gran?"
I looked up at old Mrs. Hempstock with hope on my face and waited.
"Don't say I didn't warn you if it all goes wobbly," said old Mrs. Hempstock.
"Oh, thank you, Gran. I won't. And I'll be careful." Old Mrs. Hempstock sniffed.
"Now, don't do anything stupid. Approach it with care. Bind it. Close its ways. Send it back to sleep."
"I know," said Letty. "I know all that. Honestly. We'll be fine." That's what she said. But we weren't.
Chapter 4 Letty led me to a hazel thicket beside the old road. The hazel catkins were hanging heavy in the spring, and she broke off a thin branch. Then with her knife, as if she had done it 10,000 times before, she stripped the branch of bark, cut it again, so now it resembled a Y. She put the knife away, I did not see where it went, and held the two ends of the Y in her hands. "I'm not dowsing," she told me, "just using it as a guide. We're looking for a blue bottle, I think, to start with, or something purpley blue and shiny." I looked around with her. "I can't see one." "It'll be here," she assured me. I gazed around, taking in the grass, a reddish-brown chicken pecking at the side of the driveway, some rusty farm machinery, the wooden trestle table beside the road, and the six empty metal milk churns that sat upon it. I saw the Hempstock's red brick farmhouse crouched and comfortable like an animal at rest. I saw the spring flowers, the omnipresent white and yellow daisies, the golden dandelions, and do-you-like-butter buttercups. And late in the season, a lone bluebell in the shadows beneath the milk-churn table, still glistening with dew.
"That?" I asked.
"You've got sharp eyes," she said approvingly. We walked together to the bluebell. Letty closed her eyes when we reached it. She moved her body back and forth, the hazel wand extended, as if she were the central point on a clock or a compass, her wand the hands, orienting toward a midnight or an east that I could not perceive.
"Black," she said suddenly, as if she were describing something from a dream. "And soft."
We walked away from the bluebell, along the lane that I imagined sometimes must have been a Roman road. We were 100 yards up the lane, near where the Minnie had been parked, when she spotted it, a scrap of black cloth caught on the barbed wire of the fence. Letty approached it. Again the outstretched hazel stick, again the slow turning and turning.
"Red," she said with certainty. "Very red, that way."
We walked together in the direction she indicated, across a meadow and into a clump of trees.
"There," I said, fascinated.
The corpse of a very small animal, a vole, by the look of it, lay on a clump of green moss. It had no head, and bright blood stained its fur and beaded on the moss. It was very red. "Now from here on," said Letty, "hold on to my arm. Don't let go." I put out my right hand and took her left arm just below the elbow. She moved the hazel wand. "This way," she said. "What are we looking for now?" "We're getting closer," she said. "The next thing we're looking for is a storm." We pushed our way into a clump of trees, and through the clump of trees into a wood, and squeezed our way through trees too close together, their foliage a thick canopy above our heads. We found a clearing in the wood, and walked along the clearing in a world made green. From our left came a mumble of distant thunder. "Storm," sang Letty. She let her body swing again, and I turned with her, holding her arm. I felt, or imagined I felt, a throbbing going through me, holding her arm as if I were touching mighty engines. She set off in a new direction. We crossed a tiny stream together. Then she stopped suddenly and stumbled, but did not fall. "Are we there?" I asked. "Not there," she said. "No, it knows we're coming. It feels us, and it does not want us to come to it." The hazel wand was whipping around now like a magnet being pushed at a repelling pole. Letty grinned. A gust of wind threw leaves and dirt up into our faces. In the distance I could hear something rumble like a train. It was getting harder to see, and the sky that I could make out above the canopy of leaves was dark, as if huge storm clouds had moved above our heads, or as if it had gone from morning directly to twilight. Letty shouted, "Get down!" And she crouched on the moss, pulling me down with her. She lay prone, and I lay beside her, feeling a little silly. The ground was damp. "How long will we—" "Shush!" She sounded almost angry. I said nothing. Something came through the woods above our heads. I glanced up, saw something brown and furry, but flat, like a huge rug flapping and curling at the edges, and at the front of the rug a mouth, filled with dozens of tiny sharp teeth, facing down. It flapped and floated above us, and then it was gone. "What was that?" I asked, my heart pounding so hard in my chest that I did not know if I would be able to stand again. "Manta wolf," said Letty. "We've already gone a bit further out than I thought." She got to her feet and stared the way the furry thing had gone. She raised the tip of the hazel wand and turned around slowly. "I'm not getting anything." She tossed her head to get the hair out of her eyes without letting go of the fork of the hazel wand. "Either it's hiding or we're too close." She bit her lip. Then she said, "The shilling. The one from your throat. Bring it out." I took it from my pocket with my left hand, offered it to her. "No," she said, "I can't touch it, not right now. Put it down on the fork of the stick." I didn't ask why. I just put the silver shilling down at the intersection of the Y. Letty stretched her arms out and turned very slowly with the end of the stick pointing straight out. I moved with her but felt nothing. No throbbing engines. We were over halfway around when she stopped and said, "Look." I looked in the direction she was facing, but I saw nothing but trees and shadows in the wood. "No, look, there," she indicated with her head. The tip of the hazel wand had begun smoking softly. She turned a little to the left, a little to the right, a little further to the right again, and the tip of the wand began to glow a bright orange. "That's something I've not seen before," said Letty. "I'm using the coin as an amplifier, but it's as if—" There was a whoomph, and the end of the stick burst into flame. Letty pushed it down into the damp moss. She said, "Take your coin back." And I did, picking it up carefully in case it was hot, but it was icy cold. She left the hazel wand behind on the moss, the charcoal tip of it still smoking irritably. Letty walked, and I walked beside her. We held hands now, my right hand in her left. The air smelled strange like fireworks, and the world grew darker with every step we took into the forest.
I said I'd keep you safe, didn't I? Said Letty.
Yes. I promised I wouldn't let anything hurt you.
Yes.
She said, just keep holding my hand. Don't let go. Whatever happens, don't let go. Her hand was warm, but not sweaty.